Christians should operate fully in the public square, and that includes by engaging with the media.
Molly Hemingway talking about her joint presentation at the 2017 Fall Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference.
And one of the things that they can do is encourage reporters to report things accurately and truthfully. They can express their opinions in letters to the editor and op-eds. And one of the things that's important is to just let people in the world know of the differences of opinion that are out there, that Christians don't share a lot of the secular thinking that is promulgated by the media. And so being bold and being able to stand up and simply speak truth in the public square, it's a powerful witness to others, and it's a service you can perform for your community and the country at large.
You can meet and hear Molly and Mark Hemingway making the case for Christians engaging the news media at our Fall Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston, Texas. Learn more at issuesetc.org.
Oh, come on. Woo. Let's get it on. Ah, baby. Let's get it on.
We hear it all the time. Love, they're consenting adults. As long as two consenting adults, it's almost become a cliche, decide to do whatever they decide to do, whenever, wherever they decide to do it, who are we to judge? That is really, in a lot of ways, the only principle that still stands after the sexual revolution in the culture when it comes to sexual morality, to consenting adults. Of course, the number two is a fluid as well, and it seems as though, as the sexual revolution advances, that adults also is a fluid definition. And maybe, who knows? We got guys like Harvey Weinstein. Maybe even consenting might be a fluid definition as well. Joining us to talk about rethinking consent-based sexual morality, David French, senior writer for National Review. He's a constitutional law attorney and graduate of Harvard Law School, veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom, and author of a recent column titled, It's Past Time to Rethink Modern Sexual Morality. David, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Why is the left suddenly outraged at the sexual behavior of Harvey Weinstein?
Yeah, you know, I think the victims have always been outraged, but a lot of people were afraid of him. And I'm not talking just the victims, but I'm talking about journalists and others who knew what was going on. And they weren't just afraid of him, they were also ambitious. And they saw him as the key to perhaps their own career dreams. So I think what you had was a combination of victims who were caught in situations where, as we're now familiar with the Weinstein method, that they would be introduced to him by someone else, say a female producer or a female assistant, and then they would be ushered into another room where it was just the two of them alone. And they were put in this terrible he said, she said situation. So the victims, you know, were in a far more disadvantageous position. But then there are other things that happened out in full view of the public, even in full view, say, of photographers and journalists. But no one really blew the whistle on him. And I think part of it is there was fear. And I think part of it is they rationalized not blowing the whistle because there would be always somebody else who could. And besides, I mean, he could get their scripts greenlit. He could help them in their careers. So I think there was a lot of cowardice going on. Again, not on the part of the victim. The victims were in a terrible situation, but on the part of a lot of people around him in the industry.
Not legally, but at least according to the modern sexual ethic that you write about recently in National Review, if Harvey Weinstein were to say, look, we were all consenting adults, they may have thought I was, you know, a powerful man, but at least at the time, we were all consenting adults ethically, according to the sexual revolution's ethic. Would that take some of the heat off of him?
Oh, it'd take, according to the sexual revolution's ethic, it would take all the heat off of it. You know, essentially what the sexual revolution's morality is, in a nutshell, is absent very extreme circumstances, like, say, incest, whatever consenting adults do is their business. And so what that means in practice, though, is that virtually every encounter, human encounter, is subject to being potentially sexualized. In other words, a business meeting, well, a business dinner, an encounter with a married man or a married woman, and any kind of event can have that undertone or that overtone to it. And the only question is, well, do both parties consent? But the problem, of course, is how do you know if there's consent unless somebody makes a move, unless somebody makes the ask? And then that's what starts to put people in these incredibly difficult positions.
So let's talk about that ethic, consenting adults. How does it, in going into some more detail, how does it sexualize almost every adult encounter and relationship that we have?
Well, there's no boundary. In other words, the only boundary that exists is whether somebody wants to or doesn't want to. So there's no other formal boundary. Like, let's say, for example, under traditional sexual morality, if you're in a meeting with a married man, you would never have to worry that they were going to proposition you. Or under rules of propriety and ethics that generally have traditionally governed business relationships, if you're going to a business dinner or a business meeting, you wouldn't have to worry that somebody was going to proposition you, because that was off limits. That was out of bounds, that sexual relationships should be limited to relationships between a husband and a wife. And so you would have a degree of freedom from the sexualization of, you know, any given encounter. But in the consent-based morality, really nothing is sacred. No relationship, no encounter is something where sex would be off limits, so long as, you know, both parties consent. But again, the other key part of this is, it's not like you walk around with a sign flashing over your head that says yes or no, so that everybody can see. The only way you know if there's going to be consent is if you make an ask, if you make a move, if you're aggressive in some sort of way. And so what that then means, and women in Hollywood are coming forward to talk about this in droves, is that they will be propositioned constantly. They will be facing constantly having to fend off advances, often from people who are very powerful and people who have a lot of control over their future. And that's unacceptable.
Can we go so far as to say that this consent-based sexual ethic of the sexual revolution is intrinsically oppressive?
Oh, I think it absolutely is, because when you combine it with human nature, so when you combine it with that very powerful sex drive, you combine it with human nature. Once you combine it with human nature, rather than living in some sort of utopian land where people can sort of treat sex transactionally, but when you combine it with human nature and you understand that you've then sexualized essentially all of life, then you do have a situation. And we're talking about this in the context of Hollywood, but what about all those millions and millions of women who aren't actresses, but who you know, they want a job, or they want to continue with in a relationship with a guy, but they may not be wanting, you know, may not be ready to be sexually active with that person, or may have moral qualms about it, but there's a power imbalance because they want to continue that relationship so badly. Yeah, we start to reach a point where you have people being put time and time and time again in situations where the demand essentially yield to my sexual advance or lose something that you value. And that is, I think, intrinsically oppressive.
David French is our guest. We're rethinking consent-based sexual morality with him on this Tuesday afternoon. When we come back, I wonder if this helps us understand why, remember during the presidential election, then candidate for Vice President Mike Pence, they brought up something he'd said about a decade ago about not eating dinner with a woman who wasn't his wife. And everyone thought, especially those on the left, thought that was hilarious. Maybe it has something to do with this consent-based sexual morality. Stay tuned.
Things when I hear on the radio tonight about Obama being a Christian but not being good because of his pro-choice and homosexuality stances.
Here's a recent comment from the Issues Etc. comment line.
Yet I see no evidence of any literature that in the Bible that you stated that says that these things are against biblical teachings.
The Issues Etc. comment line, available 24/7, 618-223-8382.
Have you been too busy to get your associate's, bachelor's, or master's degree? Concordia University, Wisconsin offers 50 online educational options. Find out more at issuesetc.org. Click the Concordia University online logo and enter the program code ISSUES to waive your application fee. Concordia University, Wisconsin is here to strengthen and support the church. Lifelong Lutheran Learning. ISSUESETC.org and click Concordia University, Wisconsin online.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Memoria Press now offers 6 levels of the Simply Classical curriculum for students with special needs. These full-year curriculum packages for children with learning challenges enable you to teach reading, writing, arithmetic, art, poetry, science, history, Latin, literature, and Christian studies with incremental classical methods. Visit classicalspecialneeds.com and enter promo code LPR17 to save on resources for your home or school.
When a Christian woman is critical of her own flesh, she holds her Creator in contempt.
Rose Adel from her new book, Ladylike, Living Biblically.
Our Heavenly Father knit us together in the womb. He did not do a bad job. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. Psalm 139:14. That goes for everyone, including the one who thinks she's the ugliest of them all.
You can purchase and download Concordia Publishing House's new audiobook, Ladylike, Living Biblically, at Amazon, Audible, and iTunes.
We're talking about consent-based sexual morality. Our guest is David French, senior writer for National Review. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues, Etc. Making the case against sexual revolution is going to be the subject Dr. Jennifer Roback Morse is taking up at the 2017 Fall Issues, Etc. Making the Case Conference, November 10th and 11th in Houston, Texas. Now, attendance is limited to 400. It's not too late to register. You can find out more at issuesetc.org or call 618-223-8385. The Making the Case Conference, Friday, November 10th and 11th, in Houston, Texas. David, I'm wondering whether or not this consent-based sexual morality helps us understand something that happened back during the presidential election. It was brought up from about a decade ago that Mike Pence, at the time candidate for vice president, had lived by a rule of not eating dinner alone with a woman who wasn't his wife. And the left especially just thought that that was very funny and very quaint. Does it help us understand that reaction?
Well, yeah. I mean, look, people are deeply confused about this. So on the one hand, they look at the Mike Pence situation and they go, oh, you know, this is a guy, what, he can't control himself? You know, he feels like women are dangerous. No. This is a kind of situation where you acknowledge human nature and you say, well, we should not create situations, particularly when combined with alcohol, that often bring out the worst in people or often bring out, you know, often create tempting situations. You know, if you're someone who reads the Bible and understands theological reality and spiritual reality, all human beings are subject to temptation. And so isn't it rational to want to limit the circumstances in which you might be exposed to temptation? Is it irrational to want to make sure that business relationships are conducted in an environment that's less rather than more conducive to that kind of intimacy? So, I mean, but again, people are deeply confused about these issues and they're often highly ideological about them. So, you know, advocates of this sort of consent-only morality will often think, we're different. Temptation doesn't really matter to us because we just do what we choose to do and don't do what we choose not to do. But again, all of this starts to when you begin to overlay human nature on all of this, you begin to see the power of temptation and also the distortion of power imbalances. And when you put all those things together, I think the Mike Pence rule makes a lot more sense than the mockers would suggest.
Of course, all of this happens, as you say, in a context of a church that has, at least in principle, a enduring, not only traditional, but actually corresponding to reality, sexual ethic of its own, and yet you say has been in retreat. How would you track that retreat of the church on these issues?
Well, you know, there's formal retreat in the sense that we've seen many of the mainline denominations essentially change their sexual ethic in response to cultural shifts. And then there's sort of de facto retreat, in which you've seen a lot of those churches that have not made formal changes, either de-emphasizing their sexual ethic as part of, you know, their outreach to a community or even their teaching to their own constitution, preferring not to talk about it, for example, or being apologetic about it, sort of saying, well, you know, I know this seems oppressive to you, but, you know, join us anyway. And so there's just a lack of confidence, I think, on the part of many, many people in the church to assert positively and boldly these timeless truths that are actually liberating, that contribute to human flourishing. But the sexual revolution has been so all-encompassing in our culture, in our nation, that often, you know, Christians are in this defensive crouch, and they're almost like, well, you know, come to church even though we're kind of stodgy on this point of view, rather than saying we have a life-giving, it's not just a life-giving gospel, it's a life-giving morality that's connected to that gospel.
Can you connect that to, and this is probably a phenomenon of pop American evangelicalism more than anything, the tendency on the part of kind of the evangelical wing of American Christianity to, the only way I can describe it is, they say, okay, we haven't talked enough about sex, so let's put a big four-poster bed up on the dais and have the pastor get into it with his wife and preach their sermon there on sex. I mean, every single big box church pastor has tried this at one time or another, trying to say, well, we're really, really super comfortable with sex, so what we may say you can't do, well, just remember, we're really cool at the same time. How does that fit in?
Well, I mean, that just sort of fits. That's of a piece with a larger cultural problem where I would describe it as the phenomenon of trying too hard, where people are self-consciously edgy or self-consciously hip or self-consciously trying to market the church out of the box. I mean, this is something you could take sex, you could take almost anything else that the church teaches, and you're going to find some churches where pastors are trying to push the envelope in some way that's attention-getting or often signals that the pastor is particularly cool or interesting. I tend to see that not so much as a thing that is a sex issue, as an ego issue. You know, it's sort of someone just standing on a stage and saying, I'm different from everybody else. And I think it translates across issues. But yeah, I'm definitely familiar with the sort of the broader phenomenon you're talking about, where somebody gets up and in a way says, oh, look at all those other Christians not willing to talk about sex. I'm the one really willing to talk about sex. But I don't think we do, even in those churches where they're kind of so proudly proclaiming their willingness to talk about sex, they often don't go that deep, frankly. They don't talk about, you know, really the full biblical reason, the full biblical argument, the full theology of the sexual ethic of the Christian church, and that's a shame.
You write this, the natural result of the Christian sexual ethic is an intact family and a culture of human flourishing. What are you describing there?
Yeah, what I'm describing is something that we know as a matter of sociology and social science, that those who reserve sex for marriage and are faithful within marriage, who stay married on virtually every measure of human flourishing, whether it's mental health, whether it's economic opportunity, whether it's the outcomes of their children, they just flat out do better. I mean, this is just so well established. You don't even really have to argue about it anymore. It's extraordinarily well established. And so, when you talk about that, those realities being so well established, and then how neatly they dovetail with the Christian sexual ethic, you're talking about advocating a moral worldview that is good for people. That's very, very good for people. And then when you're talking about the more libertine view, the view that in the real world results in fractured families, results in, you know, multiple children with multiple different parents all within the same family, and results in an enormous amount of heartache, that's not conducive to human flourishing. And again, we know this. We know this beyond a shadow of a doubt. So on the one hand, you have a sexual ethic that leads to human flourishing. On the other hand, we have a sexual ethic that's been repeatedly tried on a mass scale since the dawn of the sexual revolution that has resulted in a huge amount of human misery. I think we've got the better end of the argument here.
Speaking of that misery, a couple final questions for you, David. Are we watching this social experiment, the sexual revolution, played out with the generation of Americans who are transitioning from children to adults. If the standard is consenting adults, seems to me that kids in high school, in college, even in junior high school, are asking, well, do I qualify as a consenting adult? And apparently, at least according to the culture, they do.
Well, you know, we have this interesting paradox going on right now. And that is, on the one hand, our culture has embraced what's some folks call a delayed adolescence. In other words, a lengthy growing up period that sometimes doesn't even culminate until people's mid to late 20s. So you have, you know, the phenomenon of so many millennials, often for economic reasons, still living with their parents. Colleges and universities are far more, they helicopter and hover over kids far more than they used to. Parents helicopter and hover over their kids, particularly middle class and upper middle class parents, more than they used to. So on the one hand, we have this delayed adolescence that sort of keeps kids from growing up. But on the other hand, there's a culture that pushes them into sexual activity quickly and enthusiastically. So which is it? Are they adult enough to engage in sexual activity, sometimes even on a promiscuous basis? Or are they actually, you know, in this extended delayed adolescence? We send kids inconsistent messages. And then we're surprised when chaos results and when we have kids with skyrocketing rates of anxiety and depression.
Finally, then, you talk about the church being in a defensive crouch, and you've described what that is. How do Christians get up out of that defensive crouch and, as you say, offer back to our corrupted culture, our fallen and dying culture, the gift of a Christian sexual ethic?
Well, some of it is Christian jellyfish needing to pray for some spinal tissue, for some spines. So, you know, we have people who are very nervous and timid about making moral arguments into the culture, about, you know, proclaiming their faith and their worldview. So part of this is just we need a little bit of moral courage ourselves. And also part of it is learning how to make the argument. It's not simply don't have sex. You know, it's not simply abstain and you won't regret it. It's there's more fullness to it. There's much more fullness to it. And learn the fullness of the argument and learn the value of, you know, so to speak, your own values and then proclaim them. So, you know, it's a little bit of courage. It's a little bit of knowledge. And both of those things will combine to, I think, a lot of confidence.
Do you think that the Harvey Weinstein, the Bill Cosby, that scenario that's played out over and over again for us in pop culture will be enough of a wake-up call both to the church so that the church can issue the wake-up call to the culture?
No, not even close. I mean, I'm not even confident the Weinstein issue will be in the news cycle in 6 days from now. So, unfortunately, wake-up calls often have to be delivered up close and personal. They are delivered in our lives, not necessarily in the lives of others. I think the Weinstein situation is the right time for maybe some of these women who are victims of his to receive justice. I think that's very powerful. It might also be a time when other people in Hollywood start to lose that sense of invulnerability and immunity that they've enjoyed, and so maybe some more abusers will come out, and that will be a degree of justice. But the culture is going to change only when millions and millions of people decide to change. And I'm not sure that Harvey Weinstein is going to be that moment any more than Donald Trump was that moment, or any more than Bill O'Reilly or Roger Ailes or Anthony Weiner was that moment, or Bill Clinton was that moment.
David French is senior writer for National Review and constitutional law attorney and graduate of Harvard Law School, veteran of Operation Iraqi Freedom, and author of a recent column titled It's Past Time to Rethink Modern Sexual Morality. You can read it at our website, issuesetc.org. Click Listen on Demand. David, thank you for your time.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
On the other side of the break, we'll be teaching a Sunday school lesson with Pastor Tom Baker. Hezekiah, a faithful king who, well, at first concedes to an enemy's demands and then goes to God. We'll be right back.
The church's music from the 20th century. The 17th century. The 11th century. 8th century. The 4th century. The best of the church's music from the past 2,000 years. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Lutheran Federal Credit Union was formed to serve you and to serve the church. Starting October 1st, this twofold mission becomes even more pronounced. During October, when you open a Lutheran FCU loan to meet your financial needs, or when you use your Lutheran FCU credit card for a qualifying amount of purchases, Lutheran FCU will give you cash back and give that same amount of money to their ministry of the month, the Concordia Historical Institute. Learn more at LutheranFCU.org. Lutheran FCU, good for you, good for the church.
500 years ago, Martin Luther published 95 Theses and changed the world as we know it. Learn more about the Reformation Luther sparked and how and why Lutherans are celebrating its 500th anniversary when you read the October issue of the Lutheran Witness. Visit cph.org/witness to subscribe to print and digital editions of the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod's flagship magazine. The Lutheran Witness, interpreting the contemporary world from a Lutheran perspective. cph.org/witness.
Your comprehensive source for information, teaching, and truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Christ Lutheran is a welcoming congregation in Rochester, Minnesota, providing traditional liturgy and hymns, word and sacraments. Call 507-289-0271. That's 507-289-0271. Or visit ChristRochester.org. Christ Lutheran Church, receiving and sharing Christ's mercy.
Would you like to help a college or seminary student attend the Issues Etc. Making the Case Conference? You can purchase a conference scholarship for a contribution of $120 to Issues Etc. You can donate online at issuesetc.org/scholarship. issuesetc.org/scholarship. Or you can make your $120 check payable to Issues Etc. Write scholarship in the memo line and send it to Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234.